Guardian Unlimited.
Newsdesk is brought to you in association with Tycoon. Six businesses, one investor. Join Peter Jones on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. on ITV1.
It's Newsdesk on Tuesday, July the 3rd. Hello, I'm Matt Wells. The investigation into the British car bomb plots is taking an international turn, but there's one common factor. Almost all the suspects have a medical connection. Our transport correspondent will have the latest on the travel situation, and there are political moves as well, with praise for the new Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, and the Tory leader, David Cameron, reshuffling his front bench. We'll have more on all of that. Plus, worries about Waitrose. Delis and independent retailers fear the upmarket food chain more than Tesco or Sainsbury. There'll be a canter through the morning papers and a dip into John Henley's diary, all coming later. But first, police investigating the London and Glasgow car bomb plots have made more arrests. The latest came in Australia. These are the main developments. Officers in Brisbane arrested Dr. Mohammed Atif as he was boarding a plane for India. He had a one-way ticket. There are reports that he had worked in the Halton Hospital in Runcorn before moving to Brisbane. It brings the number of arrests to 8. A second doctor who'd worked in Liverpool is also being questioned in Australia. Bilal Abdullah, an Iraqi doctor arrested at the scene of the incident in Glasgow Airport, is being transferred to Paddington Green Police Station in London as Scotland Yard takes charge of the investigation. Another man detained with Dr. Abdullah remains in a critical condition at the Royal Alexandra Hospital in Paisley near Glasgow, where Dr. Abdullah had worked as a locum and where other arrests have been made. There have been controlled explosions on fire extinguishers left outside tube stations in London. This is what the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, had to say in Parliament.
Let us be clear. Terrorists are criminals whose victims come from all walks of life, communities and religious backgrounds. Terrorists attack the values that are shared by all law-abiding citizens. As a government, as communities, as individuals, we need to ensure that the message of the terrorists is rejected.
The latest arrests have underscored the medical connection. Our reporter Ian Cobain has been following the story.
They've arrested 7 people in the UK and an 8th person has been arrested in Australia. And of these, we know that 5 in the UK and 1 in Australia have medical connections. In other words, there's 6 health professionals currently being questioned by police over these attacks.
Is there any indication at the moment as to why that may be, why doctors have been involved in this?
It seems certain that they have come together after arriving in the UK from India, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, wherever else. What brought them together in the UK, whether it's a website, whether it's a physical location, we don't know. We just don't know. But it seems highly unlikely that these people would have been recruited by Al-Qaeda or other terrorist organisations and then separately dispatched to the UK.
As you say, they're all foreign nationals, but there is still the possibility that's being investigated about a British connection, isn't there?
One of those arrested does have a British connection, and we're starting to hear that one of the individuals who's been described as being foreign was in actual fact born in London but brought up overseas.
And it's clear that this is an international investigation as well.
And you can bet your life that there'll also be inquiries being made in Jordan and in Baghdad and in Lebanon as well, I would think.
The way that this has all happened and the arrests have come together is interesting as well, because presumably at the end of last week, police and the security services were off from a standing start on this.
That's absolutely right. It appears that the bombers had no idea that there was a possibility that the 2 Mercedes were packed with gas cylinders and petrol and nails were not going to explode. As a result, there's a great deal of evidence in there. There's forensic evidence, DNA evidence, and there's also mobile telephones. And it's now becoming apparent that there was records to be gleaned from those mobile telephones. Calls had been made and calls had been received on those mobiles, and the bombers thought that they would be in 1,000 pieces, and the police were simply able to trawl through those records and start from there. That took them to Staffordshire, that took them to Glasgow. By the early hours of Saturday morning, they were already looking for people in the Glasgow area, almost 12 hours before the attack on Glasgow Airport.
And they may end up catching an entire cell.
They may have already caught an entire cell, it may lead them onto other cells. I should think those 2 telephones would be an investigator's dream.
Let's look at the travel aspects of all of this now. Dan Millmore, our transport correspondent, is here. Dan, what should travellers think about if they're going to British airports today?
They should certainly contact the airport they're going to and also the airline they're travelling with before embarking on their journey. That's probably best done by checking the relevant website. Also, over and above any advice they get, they should leave probably at least an hour extra time to get to the airport.
And if getting into the airport is a problem, if they have to park a bit further away, what about getting out of it in terms of flying? Are there delays to flights?
There will be extra security measures because the security level has gone up to critical. There will be more police, and there probably will be more checks on passengers at security points. None of the airports will confirm whether or not the check level has gone up, but I understand that it certainly has in recent days, certainly since the weekend. So they should allow perhaps 30 minutes more to get through security.
Okay, so people who've been travelling over the past few days will realise that things have been disrupted, but by and large flights are getting away on time. Is that situation likely to continue or over the next few weeks?
Talk to people who operate airlines privately, and they say that within a fortnight there's going to be the real test when the schools all come out. The holiday season starts in fall, and even on a relatively benign security level, airports are really, really tough to get through in the summer, particularly places like Heathrow and Stansted. So with these extra security measures in place, it probably is going to be quite tough from the next fortnight onwards.
Yeah, it's been busy in Scotland with the start of the school holidays there, so with the start of school holidays in England in a couple of weeks could be a bit of a nightmare. What about the longer-term implications? Will these extra security measures, such as barriers outside airports and not being able to drive right up to the front of them, is that likely to continue into the longer term?
Permanent changes to the security situation at airports, indeed all transport hubs, is the purview of a group called Transec, which operates within Department for Transport. So far, they've said they are happy to leave it in the hands of local police forces. So permanent changes, no, not yet. However, what we've seen is BAA, Britain's largest airport owner, the owner of Heathrow indeed, ringing all its terminals with concrete over the past 2 days. So that at least is going to be one permanent measure we should expect to see at all airports. And the public should be reassured by that, because it means even if cars are allowed up to forecourts again, and perhaps that might happen over the next week or two if the security levels is reduced, if cars do get through, they're going to come right up against a concrete ring.
That was Dan Milmo, our transport correspondent. Now, the security and political situation seems to have had a knock-on effect with David Cameron. The Tory leader has reshuffled his front bench. Will Woodward, our chief political correspondent, is on the line from Westminster. Take us through the changes, Will.
Well, I suppose the headlines are appointments of two women outsiders, people who weren't in the shadow cabinet. They weren't even on the front bench team before yesterday. Saeed of RC, who is a Conservative vice chairman, has been appointed to look after community cohesion issues, and Dame Pauline Neville-Jones, a career diplomat who has been working on a Conservative policy review team, is going to take charge of security. Then there are some demotions and some sackings: David Willetts, Francis Maud and Hugo Swarp. Three people have all been involved in controversies of one sort and of another over the last few months, are either demoted or, in Mr. Swire's case, out altogether. And then there's some promotions for, I suppose you'd call them, the class of 2005, I beg your pardon, Michael Gove, Jeremy Hunt and Nick Herbert, all of whom have done very well on the front bench recently.
So why has David Cameron done this now? Is it a reaction to the changing security situation and indeed the changing political situation with Gordon Brown taking over?
Yes, I think more the latter. I think it's a case that they've realised for a while that they need to freshen up the top team. You can't really appoint your shadow ministers until you know exactly what you're shadowing. So, for instance, the creation of a new universities department last week. You've got a reconfigurated Department of Trade and Industry. And then Mr. Cameron needs to have people to do what David Davis called yesterday man-to-man marking. In other words, you need to get a team in place which can take on the departments and the individual departments. Also, I think he's been keen to take a leaf out of Mr. Brown's book by appointing some outsiders and promoting some women. Although Gordon Brown has cut the number of women in the cabinet, Labour now has the advantage of a woman deputy leader. And I think that in particular accounts for the appointment of Caroline Spelman as Conservative Party chairman. A slightly strange choice in many ways. She's not a particularly stellar performer, but she has got a touch of the Harriet Harmans about her, and I think that's the appeal to David Cameron.
Now, all of this comes against the background of a rather tricky situation as far as the opinion polls are concerned for Cameron, doesn't it?
They've taken a nosedive, there's no doubt about it. The Guardian ICM poll last week. The first of the new regime, if you like, showed Labour ahead for the first time since March 2006. They showed a biggest Labour lead for Labour under since David Cameron became Conservative leader in December 2005. There was a poll last night, I think, by Populus, which showed Labour ahead. So all of a sudden, the political outlook has changed. David Cameron's had a bad run in the last couple of months. Gordon Brown's had a very good run. I mean, contrary to expectations, the transition, I think, since Tony Blair's resignation in Sedgefield has actually boosted Labour, and unexpectedly in many ways. And now that and the sort of start of, I guess you'd call a Brown bounce, where people are prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt for a few months, is affecting Cameron. He says this isn't a panic measure, this is a freshening up of the team, a team to take the party on to the next election. But these are choppy waters for Cameron, there's no doubt about it.
That was Will Woodward there, and the political situation is making the papers, of course, with praise, Matt Weaver, for the Home Secretary, Jackie Smith.
Yeah, yesterday it was Gordon Brown's turn to be praised by the papers. Today it's Jackie Smith after her emergency statement to Parliament on terrorism. Rachel Sylvester in The Telegraph says Ms. Smith's reassuring manner could not be more different to the testosterone-charged attitude of her predecessor John Reid. Quentin Letts in The Daily Mail says she did no tweaking of the neck or glowering or grinding of teeth, as Mr. Reid almost undoubtedly would have done. He even tips her as the next Labour leader. Anne Trenholm in The Times...
Already?
Yeah, already, yeah. We could put £5 on it, he says.
Okay.
Anne Trenholm in The Times says it's the least frightening performance of a Home Secretary in recent memory. But Simon Hoggett in The Guardian isn't quite so kind. He says her tone was of a Women's Institute secretary explaining the arrangements for the fate in the event of rain.
Now, it's funny, Peter Wilby was writing about this in the Media Guardian on Monday. The way that papers deal with and write about women politicians is often, you know, quite misogynistic in tone. And there was, if I may say, a bit of it there from our own man. Word in the papers too, though, about another strong woman, this time down in Argentina, a new Eva Perón, perhaps?
Yeah, you won't like the language of some of the descriptions here either. The Times says that a modern Evita is bidding for the leadership of Argentina in the form of Cristina Kirchner, the glamorous wife of President Néstor Kirchner. It describes them as South America's ultimate power couple, recalling the heyday of Juan Domingo Perón and his wife Evita. Mr. Kirchner has led Argentina out of economic crisis, is stepping down to make way for his wife, a senator who the Times says has already tamed the country's Congress to do her husband's bidding. The Independent describes the presidential bid as nepotism with not a very well disguised dose of self-interest. It reckons Mrs. Kirchner is stretching a point to compare herself to Evita, who it says was idolised partly because of her humble roots. This First Lady, by contrast, is a child of a wealthy family who has earned the nickname Imelda for owning a different pair of shoes for every day of the year.
Goodness me, reaching for the journalistic cliches there. And continuing our theme of looking at women in the news, rain in Wimbledon again, but the paper's ardour for Serena Williams seems undimmed.
Yeah, after days of rain and fairly predictable tennis, the papers relish the report... The chance to report on the first genuine piece of sporting drama at this year's Wimbledon. The former champion Serena Williams had looked likely to pull out of the tournament after suffering a severe bout of cramp in her match against Daniela Hantikova, but she came through, according to The Guardian, after staggering, yelling, limping and crying in what the paper says was one of the most harrowing and improbable escapes Wimbledon has ever seen. Mm-hmm. The Express's back page has a grimacing picture of Williams with a heavily strapped leg, with the caption "Serena defies injury and hobbles to victory on one good leg."
Oh dear, oh dear. Well, we hope Serena gets better, and we hope the rain heads off as well. And we hear overnight, moving across the Atlantic to America, that President Bush is controversially commuting the jail term for his former aide, Lewis Scooter Libby, as he was known. How's that playing out in the press, Matt?
Yeah, George Bush is really facing the wrath of the American papers. Just to recap, Libby was a former chief of staff for the Vice President, Dick Cheney. He was found guilty of perjury and obstruction in the course of justice in an investigation into how the name of CIA operative was leaked to the press in an apparent revenge against her husband, who rubbished the case for war in Iraq. Yeah. The Washington Post says Libby's sentence of 30 months for the crime was excessive, but it describes Bush's decision to commute the sentence as indefensible. It adds that the $250,000 fine imposed on Libby, which still stands, is far from trivial, but it adds that neither is lying to a grand jury. The New York Times says that Bush's decision was that of someone who has little to lose. It says he is a weakened leader with his public approval ratings at a historic lows, his domestic agenda faltering on Capitol Hill, and his aides facing subpoenas. It dryly adds that these are circumstances that offer him a certain amount of freedom.
OK, Matt, well, we'll be keeping our eye on the situation over in America, and you can read a full review of the papers every day by subscribing to our email service, guardian.co.uk/wrap, that's WRAP. Now, we've heard a lot about the fears held by independent retailers about supermarket giants Tesco and Sainsbury, but a new survey shows that they're worried about Waitrose a lot more. I asked our consumer affairs correspondent, Rebecca Smithers, to explain.
They're worried that Waitrose seems to be expanding in areas where they have a stranglehold. In the past, Waitrose has really restricted its growth to sort of the home counties. It has a reputation for being a rather genteel supermarket chain, non-aggressive, quite upmarket, so it's not really a direct competition to Tesco and Sainsbury's. But we've got a new survey out last week just showing that two-thirds of deli and farm shop owners in the UK felt that Waitrose was more of a worry to them, more of a threat to their businesses than any other retail chain, which is quite interesting.
And does Waitrose have plans for expansion?
It does have plans for expansion. It hasn't given any numbers for expanding its existing 183 stores, but it's talking about doubling its annual sales over the next 10 years, which is quite a hefty expansion by anybody's measure.
Would Waitrose consider, do you think, going down the route that Tesco and Sainsbury's have done in terms of opening smaller stores, which could, I suppose, be particular threats to delis and independent retailers?
They say not. What they're planning to do is actually refurbish the existing 183 stores, and they're looking at some sort of new ways of shopping, some rather interesting models, such as, for example, having a rolling all-day breakfast, lunch and dinner service, which would allow people to, you know, too busy to cook their own meals, just to buy meals over the counter. So they're looking at some rather revolutionary shopping techniques and some new services. So it's kind of expanding and you know, going further up market rather than sort of opening all these tiny stores in city centres.
And there's greater competition in the sort of organic and high-end quality food market, isn't there, with Whole Foods, the American organic chain, opening an enormous supermarket in London, and consumers seeming to want more of this kind of stuff.
They do. I mean, that's what's quite interesting. I think Waitrose actually do see that particular store, Whole Foods Market, as a big threat to them. And although we've just got the one Whole Foods Market in High Street, Kent, they're talking about opening more than 40 others across the UK.
John Henley is here with the Diary Now. John, how are you today?
Very well indeed, thank you, Matt. Very well. We begin today, I think, with a bit of an exception here. We have our local newspaper headline of the month and our quote of the month, all in the same story, what's more. Terribly exciting. This comes from Pravda, which, as we all know, means truth. The headline is, Russian fishermen catch squeaking alien and eat it. This is, of course, the extraordinary story of village residents from the Rostov region of Russia, who, and we quote, caught a weird creature 2 weeks ago after a strong storm in the Sea of Azov. The shark-looking creature, it says, was producing strange squeaky sounds. The fishermen originally believed they'd caught an alien and decided to film it with the help of a cell phone camera. The footage clearly shows the creature's head, body and long tail weighed in at more than 100 kilograms. Pravda reports, however, ufologists and scientists were greatly disappointed when they found that the fishermen had eaten the monster. They said they were not scared of it, so they decided to use it as food. And our quote of the month comes from the chairman of the Russian Anomalous Phenomena Service, Mr. Andrei Gorodovoy. Absolutely. Who said, when questioned, and having seen the short video shot by the fisherman, said, yes, this is an anomalous creature. So, well done to him. We'll be wondering whether Green Dave is aware of the activities of this column's favourite Euro MP, Mr. Roger Helmer. He's organising an event in the next couple of days to try to disprove any human connection with global warming. There's a seminar, we have the invite actually, with talks on climate change is produced by the sun and is a warmer climate a worse climate. This follows Mr. Helmer's previous attempts to disprove climate change with the screening in the European Parliament of the film The Great Global Warming Swindle and a presentation on a counter-consensual approach to climate change sponsored, believe it or not, by Ryanair. So goodness. We do hope Dave does doesn't find out about that. Now we're going to
hope he's listening to the news desk
podcast.
Well,
let's hope so. Let's hope so. Now, yes, we're going to do a bit of a tricky little job here, translation from the German, if you'll forgive us, live on air.
Far away.
Because this is our hot new product of the week. It's called the Road Bag, and the blurb runs something like: every man knows this kind of situation in which you would give everything for a toilet. Road Bag relieves the problem once and for all. Whether you're in the car or at the festival, on a camping site or in a light aircraft, Road Bag, the pocket WC for men, absolutely, will relieve you wherever you are. It's handy, safe, hygienic, and comfortable. The great secret is the super absorber, a special granulate, if that's the word, in the inner sac, which transforms your urine into a kind of solid gel. Congratulations, only €4.99.
Do you even have to stop driving?
Probably not. Only available in Germany at the present, but I'm quite sure it'll be over here soon.
Could be useful for podcast presenters.
Absolutely, indeed. And finally, Matt, a date for your diary. This is the small village of Williston near Nantwich in Cheshire's Upper Weaver Valley, which this weekend will host the 2007 World Worm Charming Championships. We've got no idea what that's about, but we will try and find out and let you know tomorrow.
Fantastic. Thanks very much, John Henley. That's it from Newsday Today. The edition today was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. Don't forget our special sports podcast this week, Formula One from the French Grand Prix, and there's a Wimbledon special too. I hope they're ready for the rain there. I'm Matt Wells. See you tomorrow. Goodbye.
Newsdesk is brought to you in association with Tycoon. 6 businesses, 1 investor. Join Peter Jones on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. on ITV1.
Guardian Unlimited.